Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to The Mentor, I'm Mark Boris. My guest today is Jonathan Moody. Now he's the founder and CEO of Physio Inc., I-N-Q. And it's a physiotherapy business that takes people through simple changes to refine movement that have profound effects on their athletic performance and, more importantly, their pain relief. Physio Inc. started as a bricks and mortar clinic in 2006 in Western Sydney. And the business now has 14 clinics and 300 staff across Australia with a new arm of mobile and in-home care for disability and aged care. Physio Inc.'s philosophy is that your body is your most important asset, which I agree with 100%, and each part of the movement system impacts the rest of your body. They examine the entire system, measure its changes to offer preventative therapies to help respond to injuries. In the last year, Physio Inc.'s commitment to their clients went into overdrive and the business looked at telehealth offerings and how they could use technology not just as an alternative, but as potentially a superior option to face-to-face treatments. I'm going to ask Jonathan how the business was leveraged through technology and its offering, how he continually pushes for improvement, what's the importance of his distribution strategy, like franchises within an office or alternatively mobile, you know, what are the various franchise distributions, what's his product and services look like, how does he develop his product lines, and why the relationship between different sciences, which basically represent his product, is so important for his business. So let's get into it. Jonathan Moody, welcome to The Mentor, mate.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Great. This is a business called Physio I-N-Q. That's Inc.?
It's Inc., yeah.
But it's sort of not Inc., it's about inquiring or something. What's the plan of the words?
Look, when I was going to go register INC, I think I was unable to, so I threw a Q on the end instead.
In Australia, you can't, correct?
Yeah,
so because it means incorporated and we don't have that concept here.
And my little bloke at the time was going to a childcare called Thinkers Inc. And I thought, look, that's pretty good. So
I thought it might have been a play on inquiry, sort of like asking questions and being scientific. Maybe I thought bad too much.
Well, it's actually funny. The biggest search term in Australia for physio is physio in a suburb. And so I wanted Inc. because I knew that Google would just read it as Physio In, and right. Then you throw the suburb on the end of it and it would improve my organic ranking.
Yeah, so yeah. Did it work?
It did.
Well, let's just talk about, I was just reading the brief earlier and it says you were born in Adelaide and your RAAF family moved to Idaho.
Yeah.
It sounds a bit unusual. Take me back a bit. Go back and tell me what's the story about your family. Where'd you grow up?
Born in Gawler, which is just outside the Barossa. Don't know Adelaide, you know, very well in terms of growing up.
You never lived there, really?
Not really, no. Shifted over to Idaho. Lived there for a few years. My sister started her school there. My brother was young and I was also young. Came back to Australia when I was around about 4 years of age to Canberra.
Was your dad a pilot or?
He was an aeronautical engineer, yeah. So went to Mountain Home in Idaho, so really, you know, backwater USA. And, you know, Bible Belt, you know, God-fearing land, like just an incredible place and a place that I've only discovered a lot more since being an adult. And I absolutely adore, you know, backcountry USA now.
Like, how long did you live there for?
Only 3 years.
How old were you? Do you mind me asking?
I was about one and a half till four.
Okay, yeah. So you probably don't have a great memory of it then, but like a little bit maybe.
Yeah, but just have relived it as an adult, really.
We like, have relived it as an adult.
Yeah, so in terms of, my folks moved back there in 2000 and lived there for around 12 years.
Right.
They moved to St. Louis in Missouri and then they shifted to Seattle. And so in that time it was all about going back to, you know, where we were, heading back to Mountain Home, getting back to Boise, seeing all the old friends in Colorado and whatnot. And I just got a love affair with the States because I saw a different side of it that you don't see in the newspapers here, you don't see on telly. It's people that are just so warming and genuine that, you know, it was just a different world.
So I just want to get, you're born in Adelaide. You went to Idaho for a couple of years. You played rugby. I mean, that's, you went to Canberra.
Yeah, we moved to Canberra after that. And, you know, the Canberra that I remember is, I have to admit, is a lot different to the Canberra it is now. But I think generally probably society is a lot different. You know, I remember living on a street where it was, you know, really middle class Canberra, you know, where the kids would go down to the park and every single afternoon would either play cricket or play rugby. You know, we'd make our own way home on public transport. You know, it was that classic upbringing of, you know, the heading down and the local kids would all get a game of footy together. You know, it was just really classic Canberra. I mean, I didn't grow up in Sydney, but I imagine, you know, you're growing same. Up in the same thing.
Did you go to St. Edmunds?
Went to Marist. Marist Brothers,
so
yeah.
I thought you must have went to the Catholic schools.
Yeah.
And you played rugby down there.
Played rugby down there.
Yeah, because rugby is a big game down there. I mean, Ricky Stewart played, he kicked off as a rugby union player down
Pretty
there.
Pretty much all the good late 80s rugby league players were all rugby.
Were, I think he was at St. Edmunds, actually.
He was, yeah.
Yeah, and they all sort of centered around a couple of the Catholic schools down there, and they produced a lot of good footballers. And that, I mean, that was an era. The Ricky Stewart era was an era for Canberra. As a maybe they've got a new era coming, but as an era for in terms of rugby league, Canberra was a great place. I don't know what it's like now, but then I used to go down there a fair bit. It was a great community. People were a great.
We used to go down to Seaford Oval down in Queanbeyan and watch the rugby league games. My mum was a minor sponsor of, you know, Canberra Raiders with her fabric and haberdashery shop, and so we would have some of the Raiders boys like Clyde and Lazarus come in with their wives to buy sewing machines and you know, fabric and stuff to my mum's, craft shop. And so there was a real connection to those players. I remember, like, Glenn Lazarus used to live down the road from us. My old man would bail him up all the time at the shops and tell him how to play on the weekend. And, you know, and so there was that real, like, connection with people that were your heroes at the same time.
Yeah. And what's interesting, we're talking about players here who, and you, I see on the brief that you also injured your knee playing footy. And then you're in the physio business. And I I've done a bit of sport myself, and I've sustained injuries, and that whole having the ability to understand what's best for our own body as opposed to overdoing it, overworking it, or going about things the wrong way, not listening to our own body, and being aware of the signs, or not being treated properly, or not doing a full treatment process. Mm. I mean, how much of that do you think is part of what motivated you to get into what you're doing now at physio?
To be brutally honest, almost zero. Mine was just purely wanting to stay around the same identity that I had at the time playing rugby. I played rugby to a decent level, made Aussie 16s, and I hurt my neck playing against New South Wales in the lead up to heading over to New Zealand. And my entire identity.
When you say hurting, what actually did you do?
So it's called it's a subluxation. So it's like a dislocation. I didn't break it. Breaking it is often better to do because the bones heal well. But in a subluxation or a dislocation scenario, the two bones shift and the cartilage becomes damaged. So it doesn't heal very well.
Because there's not enough blood to getting around the cartilage.
Correct. Yeah. And so coming back, you know, it was crazy. I played on at the time and kind of put my head in traction. I just held my head up and tried to take the pressure off it. But every time I would go to a scrum and my head would fall forward, the pain would go away in my arms. And so I just kept trying to get into as many rucks as humanly possible. So my head would fall down. Next day, my arms and legs didn't, I was buggered. Saw physio, didn't get any scans, went to New Zealand, played the last probably 20 minutes of the game against the Kiwis. We got absolutely belted, 66-7 or something like that. Like, it was a shellacking. But got some game time, which was great. And then went back to pre-season footy in, year 12. And I just remember the first time I hit a hit shield, I was like, oh, something's not right. Like, you know, it just felt like my head was going to fall off. And went to the sports doc and had the MRI done, and the recommendation was just to not play again. And after that, you know, that void happens where I was a reasonably studious kid. Like, I was good at school, but, I was wanting to, be the be the next, you know, dentist, doctor or lawyer or physio that played for the Wallabies, you know. Yeah. It was going to be that, you know, kind of cliched story. And when that void happened, I was like, how do I stick around the game? Got into physio. Then realised that it just wasn't the same. You know, it wasn't the same. Yeah, hanging around it wasn't the same as being.
Well, can you explain that though? Do you mind explaining what do you mean by being part of it? Like, I mean, what was the attraction? So,
leadership, I think, is what I loved about playing rugby.
Them giving you leadership, or
so me.
You learning about it, or what?
Learning about leadership by, you know, leading by example, leading from the front. You know, letting your actions speak louder than your words. Having, you know, a bunch of your mates turn up to the gym at 6 o'clock in the morning because you're going to be there. You know, it was around that influence through leading by example. But then when you're on the periphery, you end up being a bit of a, you know.
Observer.
Yeah, observer and a servant. Hey, mate, I need, you know, this done and that done. And so the leadership bit wasn't present. And I didn't get into sports physio that much at all, to be honest, because from an early stage I realised that it just wasn't for me. I actually got into refereeing loved reffing for a while, but I didn't really fit in with the refereeing crowd. I liked getting on the beers with players probably too much. It was more my style to be a friend and acquaintance of the players rather than be that.
Well, you've got to remain aloof, I guess, if you're a referee.
Yeah.
I mean, the referees all hang together, I guess, do they?
They do, yeah. So they'll be hanging out and I'd be off, you know, drinking out of the boot with the boys.
Yeah,
And it wasn't a good look. Wasn't a good look.
Yeah. Yeah, have another beer, Jonathan. So make sure you ignore that
that's right.
There tomorrow. Yeah. So I'm actually quite fascinated by the concept of, you know, a stable young man. Because I can understand if somebody's unstable and they're looking for fellowship and camaraderie and things like that. You know, amongst the group, they might have a bad home situation or something like that. But like a stable young man who comes from a good family, identifying early that you wanted to be part of the momentum of a team.
Like my goal was actually early on, I wanted to lead.
Was it because you were disappointed and you were just trying to patch it up, or was it because you were – thought, okay, I'm past that now. I can't be in the Wallaby side. I can't be the only medical practitioner in the Wallaby side or whatever the dream was. But therefore, I just still want to hang around because I just like the smell of the locker room.
It was part of the grieving process, I think, you know. And it sounds silly that it's grieving, but any sort of loss that you have, you grieve.
No, you get traumatized by that sort of stuff, especially as a young man. If it's your dream got smashed.
100%. And I went off the rails at uni. Like, you know, hand on heart, I don't think I attended a lecture for the first 2 years, like, you know, of the profession that now I totally, represent, and I'm very, very fond of it. Because my identity had been changed so much that I didn't – I had a backup to my identity, but I didn't know what that was. And so I didn't attend. I used to hang out at the bar all the time. I used to fall asleep underneath the trees. You know, I'd scrape through until you couldn't scrape through anymore. And, you know, in end of second year and start of third year.
A bit like hiding in the ruck, isn't it?
Oh, mate.
Someone pulls you out.
Yeah. And, you know, and as soon as it got to, I was reading in your book that when, you know, you couldn't not go to the tutorials, like that was the bit. That's when you actually learnt how shit happens. And when I wasn't going to the tutorials, you know, all of a sudden you didn't understand any of the context or the you know, project-based learning, and I was fucked. Like, you know, in third year I started failing subjects, and then I went to the guidance counsellor. You know, he or she gave us a sheet on to, you know, fill out, you know, all of the questions about whether or not this course is good for you. And I'm reading the things and I'm like, of course I'm just going to answer that the course is shit for me. So, you know, I'm answering the sheet, trying to manipulate it so I've got the worst score in the world so that, you know, he or she's like, you should bail. And so I bailed out of uni in third year. First time I'd quit anything substantial. And
what were you, like 20,
22?
Yeah.
And so, you know, looking at going to uni, had an identity, didn't really found it hard. I saw all the rugby boys gravitating towards one another. I didn't play rugby, you know, the cricket boys were. So, you know, I just became a bit of a larrikin, which was a bit of a mask really for, you know, just hiding some own insecurities. And then, you know, in third year when I dropped out, I was always obsessed with doing lots of different jobs and trying to start businesses. In third year, when I bailed, I was going to try to get into film school, but I was just getting further away from reality, like, you know, further and further away. And so I worked for a plumber, worked for a chippy, worked for a landscape gardener, worked at a pub, got back to doing things that were real, like real work, just to recalibrate. Just physical work, yeah, just actually doing shit. Worked for a jumping castle company, you know, lugging jumping castles to kids' parties. And after doing that for a while, and I was dating a Norwegian whose dad owned a physio clinic in Norway. I went and visited him or her in Norway at the end of that year, and he just said to me, look, just get your ticket, mate. You know, you'll never forgive yourself if you don't just get your ticket. And after that, go back to doing whatever you want to do. And I took that really seriously. Like, he was a great guy. His name was Lars. And so I went back, re-enrolled, and, you know, the rest is history. Finished off in the next couple of years. My grades improved out of sight, and I actually turned up and gave a shit.
Probably a bit of maturity too.
Yeah.
I mean, like, where was your RAAF aeronautical engineer dad, like, who's gone through, who's working for the, you know, for the armed services, who generally speaking have very disciplined sort of environments around them? But what was going on there? What were they saying to you?
I reckon mum and dad knew that I was smart enough to get myself out of it.
They just were worried, so to speak.
Mum would worry about the colour of the sky. Like, my mum's a, you know, beautiful woman that, you know, will constantly keep herself awake about anything. You know, if I'm in, you know, $10 a debt or $100 million in debt, she'll have the same level of worry. She's always worried. But I think that they probably they didn't wrap me in cotton wool, but they certainly made an environment so that I could make any decision that I wanted to make, and it was just on my terms, you know, at the end of the day. They steered me in a direction when I was growing up. I largely embraced those things and, you know, was a self-motivator and self-driver of those things. But then when the wheels started falling off, you know, it was because I lived away from home, it was my narrative to them that they would experience. Yeah. Doing this for the best intentions, guys, you know, I've got this. And so that they kind of just let me roll with it. And eventually it worked out, I guess. And
it's sort of interesting that that you could have such a strong dream or story about yourself when you were a young man wanting to be, you know, play rugby, let's say, for Australia, and at the same time have a strong profession to fall back on. And, you know, as a young man, that's a pretty big thing to have in your head. But I find it really curious that your response or your reaction would be so devo when you found out you couldn't do one of those things, for a young man, like, to think that way, to feel that way, to feel so disappointed that so much so that you sort of self-destruct a little bit.
Because for me, it wasn't I would like to. It was going to have happened. It had already happened in my head. I was going to be the next Phil Kearns that was with the Wallabies. That was what I had already done in my brain. And, you know, I remember reading Napoleon Hill's book pretty soon after I dropped out of uni about Think and Grow Rich. But it was about cognitive dissociation, where the real struggle happens. Like, you can be a dreamer, but if you're not doing the actions that make your dreams come true, at some point in time, you've got to let go of it. Like, if your actions aren't matching up to the outcome you want, then you're just delusional and you become, you know, separated from any sort of reality. What you hope happens when you have a dream is that your actions follow and the habits follow, and, you know, eventually you turn the needle and you start to move in that direction. I felt like a victim that, you know,
it was not fair. Shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, fuck, it wasn't my fault. Yeah. It was my fault. I collapsed them all. That's how it happened. It wasn't my fault.
Yeah, but you didn't know the consequences.
No. Yeah. But, I guess that it was a victimhood, right? And the reality of it is, like I've thought about some, you know, tragic things that have happened. My mum and dad experienced the death of two babies underneath the age of two. They were my older brothers, Justin and Jason, and my firstborn, Justin, is named after one of them. The reality of absolute horrific situation is I wouldn't be here today if those two boys didn't die, which is a horrible, horrible thought, right? Like, I would never be here on earth, and I would never be with my current partner, Emily. Like, I was separated from my ex-wife, had a child with her, with Justin. But if I didn't meet Irene, I'd never have had Justin. He's an absolutely stunning kid. It's all good. And I think I've realised that just the victimhood is just fucking pointless.
Totally.
It is pointless. Just today's day zero every day. Just keep going forward.
So I mean, the takeout that you're sort of talking to our audience about here is just stop feeling sorry for yourself, get on with it.
It's day zero every day.
So you probably wasted a couple of years of your life fucking around, you know.
It was good fun.
Yeah. It's wasted but not wasted sort of thing. I mean, you got a good experience from it, and it does form part of your story now of who you are.
Yep.
But old Lars, he gave you a good steer, didn't he?
It's a good steer, yeah.
I mean, how important do you think that?
That conversation, if I didn't have that conversation with
you. Yeah, where do you think you'd be?
Probably running a pub.
Mm.
Probably running a pub.
Yeah.
I was working at the DY Hotel for a while and went over to Norway to visit him, and I would be running pubs.
Yeah, so it's funny how things happen to us, but Lars just tipped you into something smart. Like he used his experience just to give you one piece of advice.
Because you rarely listen to mum and dad sometimes.
Well, that's right. It unfortunately, that is the case. But Lars just tipped you into one thing, and as a result of that, you ended up finishing off your physiotherapy. So did you practice?
I did, yeah.
Did you go into it like a physiotherapy practice?
Went into a physiotherapy practice. I jumped around a little bit initially.
Doing sportsman? Or?
Ish, yeah, yeah. Straight off the bat, I was in a clinic that had a particular niche, and that niche didn't really, you know, agree with where I wanted to go. Then I got into a more traditional sports practice with a mentor of mine, Paul Wright. Was there for nearly 2 years. And I have got an issue with control, that I do like being the controller of my own future and how things roll. And so working for someone else just wasn't going to be a thing that was part of my initial journey. And so I bailed on working for someone else and set up pretty early, you know, 2 years out, which I would never recommend that to someone as a general rule.
Set up your own practice, yeah.
And within 2 years, it's pretty dumb.
Yeah,
it's a pretty dumb thing to do. Generally, there's outliers on the bell curve, but if I was going to give everybody the advice, you know, the vast majority of people, it's a stupid idea. Like, it's probably going to not work out. Your skills won't develop. You know, you won't be surrounded by people that are going to help you become a truly excellent therapist. You'll be too busy dealing with your own patients that you won't understand how to get business going. Like, there's so many reasons why it would be a crap idea.
So how long did you work for yourself in practice?
For myself, end of 2006, I did that, and I got off the tools, I'm going to say, 6 years ago. So, you know, I was working 10 years as a treating practitioner.
So do you remember the moment when you decided that Physio Inc. was the answer? I mean, what happened?
Irene and I were visiting our parents at Orchard Hills out near Penrith, and we went in to get some groceries from Woolies down in Glenmore Park Shops. And effectively, we came out with a lease signed.
A what?
A lease. Yeah,
effectively. For what?
For a room in a medical center. That was it. I was feeling a bit trapped. I was like, I kind of want to do this myself. And we went in, saw a medical center, saw Dr. Agabi and Dr. Morian. I'm like, got any rooms? Yeah, we do.
Hang on. I'm confused. You went to Woolworths to get some stuff to go and see her parents or your parents.
Yep.
And then you saw a medical center.
Yep.
And what happened?
Just walked into the medical center, spoke to the
What were you doing? What was your day job then?
Working for Paul Wright as a physio in St. Leonard's, yeah. Yep.
And then did you catch the bloke's eye or something? I mean, like at the Glenmore Park?
It was literally – Irene's great. That's my ex-wife, and she's still 50-50 owners in our business to this day. Like, it's an unusual setup, but we've proved everyone wrong and it's worked well. I knew that, you know, in that culture, they liked children to be close to home, you know, to a degree. You know, living in Alexandria is not going to cut the mustard when folks live in Penrith, right? Mm. So I thought, you know, if we're going to set up a business, it's likely to be Western Sydney.
What was her thing? She was
working at a physio clinic in Western Sydney at the time as well.
Right. Yeah, is she a physio or she was?
She's a physio.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and so we shifted. We went down into Glenmore Park Shops and large medical center. I thought, look, I just need to get my foot in somewhere. went and talked to the practice manager, sat down with, you know, Dr. Gabe and Dr. Maureen, and literally they're like, look, Peter or Paul had just shifted out, which was the previous physio here. Space is yours if you want it. Yeah, space is yours if you want it for $400 a week. That sounds good. And it was that impulsive. Like, I'll figure the rest out. You know, I know that I'm an intelligent bloke. I'll figure the rest out. You know, bought a desk, bought a bed, didn't keep any accounts for like 5 months. You know, just putting things through the FPOS terminal for 5 months. I'll figure it out later. You know, and dumped all the FPOS receipts.
And did Irene work there as well with you?
No, at that time she still worked for the same clinic that she was in, because, you know, just that building phase. You're paying rent, you're paying your accountant, having to pay your lawyer.
Some stability.
Not much money's going into your pocket for a period of time. And I started getting more popular because I was in the one room and I was a very hands-on therapist, meaning, you know, I didn't use two machines and ice. There's a funny old saying in physio, you know, steer clear of the two machines and ice clinics that put the fancy lights on you and pop some ice on you and go and see somebody else. You know, that was a thing back in the 80s and 90s, and hopefully it's not now. But shifting into that area, I was just obsessed with getting my hands on people because I knew that I needed to get the tactile, you know, feedback in order to be any good, because I didn't have any more mentors at that stage. And so I just put my hands on every single client, did as many sorts of techniques as that I could learn off in the books. YouTube physios weren't a thing back then, you know, like it was a pretty lonely existence trying to self-educate. And I went and did courses and whatnot. And I became popular because I ran on time, gave them full 30 minutes and put my hands on them. People are like, wow, you're like massaging me and stuff. That's amazing, man. And I was like, well, doesn't everybody do this? Like, isn't that what they do? So it got quite popular. We ended up buying the practice that Irene was working at, and that was in a place called St. Clair. And then within, you know, 12 months of doing that, we bought a house in Glenmore Park and relocated the practice into the house, gutted it, turned it into beds and stuff. And that was kind of how we started, yeah.
And then the biggest sort of side of this is Physio Inc. I mean, which it's not just a physio business. So when did the idea of sort of expanding yourself and turning yourself into something totally different?
Yeah.
When did that happen? I mean, where were you?
So from the outset, you know,
And is Irene still involved?
Yeah, so she's still on, like when I say on the tools, on the management tools, she's one of our, you know, very senior managers of the business. You know, as I said, 50-50 owner. We've got a more mature structure than what we have ever got now. So we've got, you know, a traditional executive of a chief development officer, chief operations and chief financial officer involved now. We have in our group, we're mixed between a franchise part of the business, which had I known how difficult that is to, mate, do a franchise, you scale up real quick. It's bloody hard.
Totally.
It's bloody hard work. You know, and you're taking a very small percent of,
It's hard.
But
you do lots of them.
Yeah, and then the other side of it is mobile. The
mobile meaning
in home. We go to the customer. Yeah. Mobile is very, very difficult to pull off well. Staff members can be isolated. You need large geographical areas initially. It takes a long time to leverage to confine your staff members into one smaller area that becomes economically viable. Like, that was a real pain in the ass early on. But we are there now. So in our group, we've got around 300 employees, about 200 direct employed, 100 underneath the franchise business. It's a more mature structure. But we grew that way from building our clinics to begin with. We initially vertically integrated all of our practices. We brought in massage, acupuncture, podiatry, you know, everything. And then we realized we were shit at everything and we should just stick to one thing in the clinics, in the bricks and mortar practice, because if you have one physio, one pod, one massage therapist, they don't have mentors around them to help them grow. So we were like, oh, look, let's go back to what we know really, really well with our bricks and mortar practices. Physio and bricks and mortar practices have 3 to 6 of them in each clinic. They can teach each other how to grow. Often, you know, there's this obsession with offering heaps of different products. Sometimes offering one product really well is the best thing you can do, right? So we did that with our bricks and mortar practices and then franchised them, franchised our best ones. We kind of left ourselves with the less performing ones to demonstrate that we were able to turn it around with our own system.
We're going to go to the break. When I come back, I want to talk about your product. I want to talk about how you distribute it and why that we did talk. We touched on the decision of franchising. We also touched on what your product suite was and how you've expanded and you contracted it, and you may well have expanded it again since. And that's all a timing thing. And I want to talk about how you market your business, and I want to talk about the importance. You said you had 200 people with you. I want to talk about the importance of the investment in the human capital around you, particularly in a business like yours. Then I want to talk flippantly about this whole concept of what a physio offers you today. I mean, I have experienced the different coloured lights and the ice, and there's nothing more.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Aggravating to me than that. I feel like I'm in a snake oil situation, and you're paying for it. And I know it does fuck all for me. I can put my own arm in ice, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you get tennis elbow, I can put my arm up, I can put it on ice myself. I want someone actually to rub it out or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
Because it's a tactile thing, physiotherapy. Yeah. That's what's called physiotherapy for, I guess. So we go to the break, we'll come straight back. I'm here with Jonathan Moody, and Jonathan's the founder and CEO of a business called Physio Inc., which is obviously a physiotherapy business, but it's more than that. And I want to talk to him. We've been talking about sort of how he got into it. It was I wouldn't say a rocky road. It was a road with many turns, though. And he's still in that business with his former wife, and that's pretty unusual. That's pretty rare, actually. So that in itself is a feat from my point of view. I was never successful at doing anything like that. You have decided, in order to get scale, to distribute your product. We're going to park what your product is, come back to it in a moment. But how did you make the decision to distribute your product? So some people might say, let's do it online. Other people might just say, I just want to have one little shop at Glenmore Park and you come and see me. Other people might say, I'm going to do a mobile one, or I go and see you. Other people say, I'm going to do a franchise. You had a little bit of everything. Tell me the decision-making process, and where did you land?
Yeah.
Ultimately.
So why we went to franchising as the first, because we went to franchising at a similar time that we started to do in-home care as well. And because we hadn't nailed the offering of in-home care.
In-home care, just give me
a... So we would have our therapists drive to people's houses.
A mobile.
Mobile
service.
Yeah. Because we hadn't nailed that, we hadn't made that financial... Difficult to go and convince somebody else to buy into that, right? So we maintained that being our own service offering and franchised our clinics. The fundamental reason why we did it, when I looked at what I wanted my vision to be, I have a fair chip on my shoulder about, I'm a why not person, right? Like somebody will ask me, why are you doing it that way? It's like, mate, why not? Like, let's try something different. And I had a chip on my shoulder about the industry because of the two machines and ice thing. I could count on, I'd have to take my shoes off to count the amount of high profile clinics that were two machines and ice when I got out of uni. Like, it killed me. And so I wanted to try to have influence on how we did things. So I wanted to get to scale to get that influence. But I realized that that's not 10 clinics. Like, that's 100, like 10 clinics is not going to get me the influence to be able to impact the university structure. Just for the listeners, university really disappointed me. I wanted to go there to have my brain expanded, but I was taught to swim in a very tight lane.
Mm.
I went and did science though, right? Like, you know, and so I remember my last 2 years, like all I would do was memorize the textbooks, and I got great marks. I'm like, fuck, that's not hard to do. Memorizing textbooks isn't expanding your brain. It's like really teaching you to be a, you know, convergent thinker, like getting really in the lanes. And so I had a chip on my shoulder that we need to, you know, chiropractic's been around for 3,000 years. And have we really nailed what works and what doesn't work? And why are we, with our evidence-based medicine, why are we saying that the psychology of the person should be removed? Why are we saying that the social impact of the person should be removed when looking at a scientific study? And so I wanted to start to push all that shit back into the evidence-based studies and say, it's really important what social background the patient comes from. It's really important, you know, what their culture is. It's really, all of those things impact on their recovery speed, on their commitment to rehab. So why are we removing it? In order to get that influence, I need to get scale. Let's build a network of clinics. I'm still really small, so I needed to franchise it. I had falsely assumed that you franchise, you know that your model is the best model and that everybody, you know, you just open the door and they all come piling in. Wow, it's hard.
Did you sell the franchises?
Yeah, we did. And we sold them internally, sold them to staff members that had been working for us to try to maintain the culture, and that was a very purposeful
thing. And what was
the
franchise? What did you sell? Did you sell them a postcode or?
So each one, depending on how many people live in their area, will get an exclusive area from which.
So it's based on numbers?
Based on numbers.
So like I'll give you an area of 40,000 people.
Like that.
And that'll be 5 postcodes or whatever it is.
Yep.
And exclusivity?
Exclusivity inside that area.
Inside that area. Yeah. And is it a bricks and mortar?
Bricks and mortar model.
So that they open up a shop somewhere.
Yep.
To service the area.
Yep.
And then you take a royalty or?
Originally we took a royalty.
Yep.
So
basically clip everything that they made.
Yep. And that was effectively limitless. Which
did you source the customer? Did you find the customer for them, the client?
So we run their websites.
Yep.
We help them. So we give them all of the digital infrastructure that they need to be able to get a certain amount of customers. The other half of the equation is face-to-face marketing, which is really important inside communities. We give them the infrastructure and the collateral and the plan, and you know it's a seasonal plan.
Yeah.
You know, this month go and do this. This month go and do that. Yep. Here's your brochures, etc. So we give them all of the marketing support. We also give them a learning management system. One of the hardest things about running an allied health or any service business is training. You know, it's
you mean PD, professional development?
Professional development, but human development. You know, like at the statistics that we run, it's not as important how well trained they are in physio. It's how important how good they are as a human.
Yeah, but people.
And it's really hard to unpack somebody that says, but I'm a really good therapist and I'm telling the patient what they need and they'll never come. And why aren't they coming back? They're not coming back because you're a bit of a, you know.
They don't like you.
You're not listening, mate. You're not listening to what they need. So all of our learning management is all geared towards making them better at dealing with human beings. And so we license all of that, you know, IP with the stuff to them. There's a business management system that runs with it. And it works well. It works well. But I realized that, you know, I've got to add more value and charge them less in order to really get to scale. Because I thought I was charging, you know, a low enough amount, but the market's telling me, oh, mate, 5% is a lot. And I'm like, fuck, I'm running at a loss with my franchise business, champ, and you're telling me this is a lot.
Which means you can either do one or two things. Either you can charge more or get more.
Correct.
Or do more.
Or do more. Yeah. So we started to try to add more, you know, to them. At the same time, I was like, look, if they hit a certain size of their business, I'm going to stop charging royalties as well and just cap it. So we went to we've just recently pivoted to a cap system where they get charged royalties up to a particular cap on a monthly basis, which means if you go crazy and you have absolutely nailed it, you've got the upside.
Yeah, you're the franchisee.
Yeah. So we've kind of removed all exit fees actually, so they can leave.
If they want to terminate, you mean?
They want to terminate, go on their merry way. Reason why I did that was I wanted to hold our staff really accountable to making sure that they provide them the best service that they possibly can.
You're talking about your franchise managers.
Correct. Yeah. Like they've got to be servants to these guys.
Yeah.
You know, and want and provide so much value that the franchisees want to stay in.
So someone who's listening is talking about the theme about franchising, doesn't matter what it is, but what are some of the pitfalls that you learn about franchise? I mean, what are some of the difficulties? Because there's no point just, I mean, I've had some experience with it, there's no point just sending out a franchise manager for this area of these 20 franchisees and go and just glad hand them, say, how you going, Jonathan, let's have a cup of tea. You've got to actually add value.
Yeah.
Otherwise, get out of my office and you're wasting my time.
Yeah. So their time's so valuable, right?
So what could you share with our listeners about franchising? Because it is a tough gig.
You've kind of got to, like, we ended up being effectively being part of their mentor group. You know, as the franchisor, we are meant to be the ones that understand the model. We're meant to be the ones that understand the human interaction elements. So hold their hand and be like a business coach, be a, you know, life coach for them and for their staff, and really set goals on each of those and get them to hold themselves accountable to those goals. So the value that you've immediately doubled your value, you know, like coaches can cost $2,000 to $3,000 a month. If you can provide that infrastructure at the same time as having the compliance looked after, all of a sudden it's not them feeling as though they're being checked on every month. It's that you're helping them grow.
That's an important thing. That's a very important thing you just said. You can't have the franchise manager being someone who's going, so we haven't hit your numbers.
Yep.
Or it can't be, I'm not there to check up on you.
Yeah.
I'm there to help you.
Yeah.
And about whatever it is you want to talk about. That's an important point. And, how many do you have now, for example, right now?
We've got 14 clinics at the moment.
14 clinics.
Yeah. And I'm the one thing that seems to be uniform is the ones that want to serve their staff, you know, that they put all the bullshit aside. They're the ones that want to serve their staff the most, seem to be the most successful.
The best proprietors of your franchisees
are
the ones who want to look after their staff members.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not, what about their customers?
So when you look, their customer in physio land, the owner of the business's customer is the employees because they're bloody hard to get.
Because it's hard to employ people.
They're bloody hard to get. It's not that it's hard to get a good one. It's hard to get any.
Yeah.
Like they're just, they're hands
to. These are, I mean, I don't want to.
University trained physiotherapists.
Right, physios. Okay.
And then again, we're talking about the bricks and mortar. It's even worse with speech pathology, occupational therapy, you know, the professions that we have in our mobile business. It's even worse. They're as rare as you get. So it's about looking at, for us, we look at the different layers of who the customers are. If you're a business owner and your major driver of business is your physios, there you got to keep your customers super happy. If they're super happy, then they'll keep 60 customers each happy every week.
Right.
Yeah. The getting customers in the door is actually not very difficult. It's making sure that the frontline staff members are super well supported, that they're trained well, and that they align with our house rules. Our house rules are employees first, which is like, you know, customers first. Our second one is referrers are treated like royalty and that customers deserve an incredible experience. It's no promise of improvement. It's no promise of outcome, but you're going to have a really good experience. And, you know, talking about two machines and ice, it's a crap experience. You know, it's you feel violated. You're about passing your card over and you're like, so Mark, I'll see you Thursday. Oh, I'll book it in. I'll cancel via text message in 20 minutes, champ. That's how it's, that's what's going to happen here, you know. And so it's the ones that value their staff the most are the most successful.
It's funny. We are talking about PhysioWink's distribution policy and the way you distribute your product and your service. Which is through one of the ways you've decided to do is through franchising. Can we just talk about your product, service product? Interchangeable, but you just mentioned speech therapy and other things. What does your product suite look like now? And when do you expand your product suite? When do you contract it?
It's a great question because I was talking before about how I contracted it and stuck to in bricks and mortar clinics, sticking to physio. Unless you can have five or six service professionals, and again, I'm in the service game where it's, you're needing to keep a certain level of expertise up in order to stay relevant, in order to stay hungry and, you know, to be well-educated. Unless you have four to six that can come together in a group, you're really struggling to get excellence because the one person, let's say they're an acupuncturist, you know, and we do still have acupuncturists in our group, they're isolated. And if they have a really difficult client that they can't get any progress with, you know, they look around, there's no one to help them. They can't ask a physio how to do better acupuncture. And so you don't have that, you know.
Collaboration.
You don't have it. So then moving on to the mobile part of our business, we have experienced time and time again, as soon as we get critical mass with four or five professionals that can come together and collaborate in an area, we're off to the races. It's wonderful. So, you know, that critical mass with those service arms for us, it was really difficult. The first one we did, which was occupational therapy. Yeah, physio, I mean, you're a physio company. You don't know, are you going to change your name? It's like, look, the name doesn't matter to the end customer, to be honest. It just doesn't. The way that we market, the customer doesn't give a shit. They land on a landing page, they look at the information, and they're like, this is who I want to go and see, and they book in. Matters more to the employees feeling as though they're working for a physio company as an OT or a speech. That's been one of the things we've found. But now our culture and brand is becoming so organic and really visceral that even the staff members that are OTs or speeches kind of like, yeah, I think I get it. You know, this is a feeling and a movement. It's not just it's not a mask. You know, yeah. It's something that's really organic. I could change our name to anything and it won't really change it.
Yeah, well, over time. I mean, so your products include, when you work there out, there's demand for a speech therapist in this area.
So in the clinics, because they're connected to their local community, and they're taught how to really stay connected to their local communities, the franchisees, they really drive what products that they need to provide.
And right, you leave it to them.
Leave it to them. They are limited to Allied Health,
right?
You know, which is no limitation,
yeah.
You know, effectively. In terms of the mobile, we advertise broadly through content-based marketing. When we start getting enough queries in a particular area, we'll try to mobilise a workforce to get into that area, and it's frustrating because you're kind of pissing people off for a little while because you don't know where there's not demand, and they're coming and saying, "Oh, look, you're saying that you're nationwide. Serve me." It's like, yes, like we will get there, and we're trying to use telehealth as a stopgap measure. Telehealth's got a long way to go for widespread acceptance.
Physiotherapy,
hard. It's hard, you know. So. You know, for physio and OT and speech, is with anything that you're trying to develop a relationship with the person. Yeah. One of the interesting things about telehealth is you can do more things sometimes on a telehealth screen that you can't do face to face. Like, you know, if you're working with a child with autism spectrum disorder, you can just say, "Hold on, you know, Patrick," and you jump off screen, you come back, and you're dressed as Superman. You know, and so you can interact in a way that you just can't interact with when you're face-to-face. You know, you can use filters and, you know, funny face filters and stuff on the camera, which can improve the experience for certain groups.
So your product suite, I guess what you're saying is, though, is that in terms of the marketing of your products or your marketing your content, you're sort of backfilling. You're sort of saying, okay, well, there is demand there, which makes sense for me to have one of my franchises or a mobile service start to push into that area. Correct. Then you have the issues of recruiting the right people and fucking that up.
And then getting to that critical mass of them feeling supported.
Yeah, and trying to make a dollar out of it as well, so which is pretty hard. I guess, you know, what are we saying? This is not for the faint-hearted, for those people listening. I mean, health services are incredibly in demand, really important today, but it's hard to do a startup and build a business around it. You've got to be patient and you just got to do one step after the other, and sometimes you're going to go back three or four steps. And then you're backfilling all the time too, both in terms of your distribution, how you distribute, the different modes of distribution. Sometimes people might criticise you and say, well, mate, make your fucking mind up. Are you going to be a franchise? Are you going to be a mobile? Are you going to be both? Are you going to be some percentage of both? Well, Kerry Pegg once said to me, he said, just do everything and work out where it all lands.
The market tells you.
Someone else will tell you, won't work it out ever.
And one of the things that we're pretty obsessed with is, in a growing business, our retention rate is landing on a yearly basis somewhere between 5% and 8% turnover, which is pretty good for a health services business. You know, meaning that,
I mean, if it's 100%, it means everyone's always sick, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, and
you didn't fix them in the first place.
it's actually a lot easier to scale if you don't give a shit about staff turnover.
Mm.
Like it's quite easy to scale if you don't care about that critical mass of having them supported and producing a quality outcome, we could really go. However, we measure, you know, net promoter scores of our customers religiously. We make sure that our referrers are, you know, receiving the best quality care. As part of that, we need to only scale in accordance to quality. And it's not just lip service. Like we're doing it, and that's why we have such low turnover.
Yeah, scale and quality. I think that's in your game, scale and quality is really important.
Yeah.
You're not selling widgets. I mean, it's...
Where our model's going to go is that our front of house is going to be like a project manager of your health.
Hmm.
And when you arrive there, they'll be able to ask you a bunch of different questions. And whether or not we treat them in-house or we say, your sports doctor that doesn't exist yet is going to be, you know, Adam or Mary, whoever it is. And we want our front of house to be connecting them to, you know, be like
a marketplace.
Yeah.
You're building a marketplace because at some point going to my GP, he doesn't understand injury.
Mm.
I mean, he's a doctor. He's a general practitioner.
Physios tend to be a pretty good first place on physical health.
What you're saying is present a marketplace.
Yeah.
It could start online.
Yeah.
I mean, and where you match people, particularly on there, and this is a lifetime thing. So people could be shooting nurse from a 30, because we start to need these things from 30 on.
Yep.
Right, and it never stops. In fact, we need more later on.
It's another one of those things that bugs me about the industry of physio. There's this self-management mantra that physios are misunderstanding. It's not about a patient coming to you and you're giving them some exercises and telling them how to ice their elbow and they're disappearing. Self-management is more about the person being involved in their own care, not necessarily having to do it themselves all the time. And the best physio, so we have a metric called client visit average. It's how many initial patients come into your office for how many repeat patients you have.
Yeah, because I'm the worst. I'm the worst at physio.
Yeah.
I won't come back.
That's right. Yeah.
I think, fuck, that didn't do anything.
Correct. And so my client visit average, and the listeners will like think that I just never fix anybody, but was 100 by the time I finished treating.
Meaning, if you rang me though, I would come back.
Correct.
Simple.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't send me on them fucking texts. a text reminder there's an appointment tomorrow.
Yes.
Send that, that's fine. But if I don't reply to it and say I'm and confirm,
give you a buzz.
Ring me up, say, Mark, mate, or somebody.
I'm going to take that back to Jill, who looks after that stuff.
That's important.
That's good stuff.
Because, you know, often I get those texts, and I haven't had an injury for a while, but like I would get those texts. I've got something else I've got to do. I've got to change my appointments, my time around. But if someone rang me, I'm not going to get out of it.
And Mark, look, I'm a physio that runs a physiotherapy business and other allied health, and I'm into ultra running these days. So it was. After my void of rugby, I eventually got into marathon running, and I kind of like flagellating at the moment. I just want to hurt myself as much as possible. I'm heading down to Tassie for 100K.
Be careful,
run.
Doctor, heal thyself.
I know, and I don't ever do my own shit.
Mm.
It's funny, like
as I was saying, the cobbler's son wears the worst shoes in the street.
Yeah,
you've got to be careful that sort of stuff.
So we're all victims to it.
But if someone rang you and said, "Hey, Jonathan, mate, get in here. I know that you've just finished your 100-kilometre super marathon.
I'll see you Tuesday.
Come in."
Yeah.
And you'll say, okay.
That's where it's at. It's about managing people.
Yeah.
And our best therapists are the ones that manage them. They don't say, "Mark, when would you like to come back? Because Mark doesn't know that. He's got no idea.
Don't give me a choice.
When I'd like to come back. Never, champ.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable. You put me through pain. You stick needles in me.
Yeah.
Why would I want to do that? It's Mark. I'm seeing you tomorrow, or I'm seeing you Wednesday.
I need to see you this week.
Yeah, like you need when you're paying someone to help you with your health, you need to know that they're confident enough to know what's best for you,
and they take control.
They've
got to take control.
It's really important.
Yeah. So the marketplace, I think, is a good idea, because everyone can get access to the people they need to see, but that more importantly, they don't know who they need to see anyway. That's really cool. I think active relationships is really important. Yeah. I like that idea of being actively managing my relationship with you as my physiotherapist. I don't care what you are. I don't care which part of the medical, allied health part, which part you fit within. As long as you fit within it and you're actually there managing it for me,
your business is. And, you know, the project management approach, I think, is going to be where the future is. And I don't know if it'll have a title or if just all allied health can do it. But if we can train them to be good project management, like in my career, I saw three of my clients, I referred them back to their GPs because their neck pain was unusual. They all ended up having Hodgkin's lymphoma. And physios sometimes can feel that things are off physically, right?
Mm.
And so I ended up being a referral network people would come to me, often I wouldn't even touch them. You know, it would be, this looks like this, and off they go. And that's not unusual in the physio world. But we do become so obsessed with not letting patients have regular touch points with us because of this self-management. Like, I think it's nonsense. We need the people to be coming back for their 10,000 kilometre checks, you know, like come back, have a chat.
Yeah, with your car.
Yeah. Like we do it very willingly.
I think we forget about how our bodies wear out too, or how our bodies need to be. It's not just enough to do exercise. It's not just enough to eat well. It's not just enough to sleep well. Your bodies wear out irrespective.
Yep.
I mean, when you think about the miles we do, bloody hell, it's amazing. And we need someone, a mechanic, to come and have a look every now and then.
Yeah.
And regularly.
Yeah.
I mean, as I said, everyone's got to remember this. You know, the cobbler's son wears the worst shoes in the street. All of us are cobblers and none of us look after ourselves.
Yeah.
Yet we're all out there very happy to give everyone else advice and tell them how to look after themselves.
And one of the biggest pieces of advice I give people is that use the insanity principle when you're going to see anybody. If it hasn't worked, go harder or change course.
Drive mad.
Yeah, you're like, go harder or change course. You either, if you're at a physio clinic and they're not getting you any better, if you're working with a speech pathologist and they're not improving the outcome, change course or double down on it. Do twice as many of it, you know, like change one of the variables.
Just don't do nothing.
Just don't do nothing. And just don't do the same shit that you were doing that wasn't doing anything. And I think that with business, that's fucking really important.
Well, it's been a very interesting conversation with you, Jonathan. I always give everyone an opportunity to ask me a question. If you've got a question you want to ask me.
Yes. I'm fascinated by the way that rents are going in this country.
Commercial rents, you're talking about?
Commercial rents, yeah. And with rents going up all the time, and it doesn't seem to be our product cost for service is improving at the same rate for a square metre basis.
A bit like our wages.
When are we going to run into that point
now?
Where,
yeah. I think COVID has actually introduced us to that a little bit. I think the big issue is that commercial, let's take ourselves out of shopping centres and just talk about strip shops, you know, like along a road. The big issue is that the commercial building owners, most of them got debt. So they have debt with the bank, and the bank usually has a covenant on the property that every 2 years they get a valuation, which means if the valuation doesn't come up to the valuation, they can ask for which means the percentage of borrowing against the valuation goes above, say, 60%,
yep.
The bank can ask you to tip some dough in.
Yep.
It's a big problem for landlords. It's a big problem for the banks too, I guess. And the way the valuations are done, the valuation industry is done by valuers, they're going to hate me saying this, but what they do is they take the passing yield and they multiply it by a risk factor. So they might say the return in Darlinghurst in Sydney needs to be, because of the risk associated with Darlinghurst, needs to be 4% per annum, for argument's sake, which means you get a multiplication factor of 25, which means you multiply the passing yield by 25, that gives you the valuation. It's formulaic.
Yep.
There's nothing subjective about it.
Mm.
It's just objective and it's mathematically based and it's extraordinarily formulaic. So therefore, the landlords can never afford to reduce the rent.
Mm.
The landlord's better off saying, see you later if you want to continue paying the rent and hanging out and not putting anyone in there than losing 6 months' rent than they are of doing a new lease with a lower rent. Because the moment they do that, that usually will kick in, because the moment I sign you as a new tenant, I have to go back to the bank and get the bank to approve you as a tenant. That's usually a covenant as well.
Yeah.
And the bank says you're paying less rent than's in the valuation.
Yeah.
And then they say, well, we need a new valuation, which means the landlord's got to tip dough in. So landlords are resisting like crazy renegotiating commercial rents. No, I'm not talking about big shops, I'm talking about just generally smaller places.
Yeah.
But I think we're at a breaking point now.
It feels like that.
No, we are. We are definitely at a breaking point, because I can just say I own a bit of commercial property and up in Darlinghurst, where once upon a time it was 100% occupied with tenants, you know, retail tenants, various other professionals, real estate agents, various other things. In a strip of 15 shops, there's 7 empty, and they've been empty now for about 18 months.
Mm.
And sooner or later, someone's going to say, fuck this. I'm not hanging out anymore. I'll take whoever I can get for any amount of rent and just put them in there and I'll bite the bullet.
Yep.
And as soon as that happens, then the whole sort of deck of cards comes down. Yep. And I think COVID actually brought this on even more.
Mm.
It sort of exacerbated the issue for landlords.
Because like the small offices that didn't need to be there, they can work from home. And
yep.
Yeah.
People say, we don't need an office anymore. Yep. I'm not going to pay $700 a week rent. I can operate from home. And councils don't help it. In particular, the city council doesn't help it, because one way you could fix this is rezone these things and say you can turn all this into residential and the landlord could go and pull a fucking thing down and build a block of apartments or something, or team up club with three or four others and build a block of apartments. But councils won't do that. They don't want this change in the demographics of the area, because that's who votes them in. Mm. So so that actually helps the cause of the incoming tenants, because landlords are trapped largely. So I think there is a change coming.
So, yeah, so the silver lining is that the squeeze is probably going to not, you know, might not burst, but it'll exhale somewhat, and the pressure will come off.
I think so.
You know, I've seen our rent-to-revenue ratios, you know, that's how we analyse everything. You know, what revenue can we get out and what's the rent? And it's really hard finding spots that stack up these days.
You'll probably find, I think you're going to find, though, that there's going to be a structural change. There is a structural change happening, but the structural change will be in that, like, let's say I previously was in Darlinghurst, but I'm refusing to pay, you know, $500 a square metre, but I now know I can go out to Regent's Park and pay $300 a square metre. I'll start putting a bit of pressure on the rents in Regent's Park, though, upwards.
Yep.
Because Mark will be moving his business to Regent's Park. What's going to happen is the expensive stuff will suffer first.
Yep.
And then it'll eventually trickle down. But what I think, what I'm seeing, what I've heard too, is that, like, for example, I'm in the city and, you know, I won't say what I'm paying, but I pay like more than $1,000 a square metre for one of my businesses. And we've got a couple of thousand square metres. And we recently thought, what we do is we'll go to Surrey Hills because we might be able to get cheaper. But everyone had already gone there, beat me to it. And Surrey Hills prices weren't too much cheaper than the city prices, but they were cheaper. But everything that was available was gone. So Surrey Hills became, or that area, Surrey Hills Central for office space became quite expensive, for big office space I'm talking about, quite expensive, relatively speaking. But city prices have come right off. I ended up renegotiating an unbelievable deal for myself. For our premises, we reduced our space. We got, you know, it's much, much cheaper than we were paying. So that phenomenon I just explained to you is actually happening, but it hasn't happened at Surrey Hills yet. It's got to trickle through right through.
So kind of like what happens at a lot more alarming speed of residential. You know, like, gee, it's expensive outside of Sydney now to buy a house. Like, you go to the Central Coast and you're paying $1 million for a house now. It's crazy.
Well, it doesn't even get you a house. In Central Coast. So I think. So the people who went from the city to Surrey Hills, so the people who ordinarily would go to Surrey Hills saying, fuck, it's too expensive, we're going to have to go to Redfern. Yeah. And the people who are going to Redfern, they're going to say, fuck, it's too expensive, we're going to have to go to blah. And it's just going to keep moving out. But the rents should scale back.
Yep.
But it's going to just take time.
Yep, makes sense.
But I think we are in a commercial price rental restructure right now. 100% in the city. For sure it's happening in the city.
Yep. And it'll trickle out.
But initially the most expensive place in terms of current rents is going to get cheaper, and it's getting cheaper. So they'll all become, relatively speaking, cheaper as the demand drops off. It's just going to keep dropping off. But you don't want to be the one, you don't think that you're going to get good deals in, if they're coming out of the city, you don't think you're going to get good deals like I thought, like in Redfern, like just because I got a shock. Okay. And there was nothing available.
Yeah.
There's not that much infrastructure. And
there does seem to be a big change in the, you know, I remember a few years ago you'd sign 5-year leases and it was really hard to negotiate anything but a 5% per year increase, like, you know, some years ago.
Yeah.
But that seems to be unheard of these days.
Well, inflation doesn't really exist like that anymore, unless you're in one of those big shopping centres, Westfield, et cetera. But you go through those shopping centres, they're dead, there's no one there.
Yeah.
And I think they'd be struggling.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.